is really problematic. So we can claim that at least in the majority of the countries of the world, the people, the population of that country, the majority of them follow one religion or another. You cannot find any, or hardly you can find any country in which no religion is practiced. I'm not talking about only Abrahamic religions. I'm talking about any religion. So Buddhism is followed in many countries. But why that country, when it comes to the rate of the crimes, they do not talk about the relation between that religion, I mean Buddhism, and the rate of the crimes? In Japan, in China, in India, in the States, in all these countries, the majority of the people, they are following, if not a religion, at least an ideology. They might be atheist. Now the question is that why you do not consider the relation between that ideology and the rate of the crime?
Okay.
Only when it comes to Islamic countries, you call them Islamic countries, and you try to draw a relation between the religion which is practiced and the rate of the crime.
Yes.
I think this is not fair, at least. This is one point. And the next point is that what do we mean by Islamic countries?
Mm-hmm.
I think even the Muslims living in these countries, none of them has ever claimed that we are practicing the religion of Islam completely. Let's take, for example, the Islamic Republic of Iran or Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Lebanon, Syria, and so on, in Indonesia, Malaysia, and so on and so forth. Although they are called Islamic countries for different reasons, and of course, for some countries like Iran, because of the fact that they have believed in the religion of Islam to be the main source for the laws and constitutions. But the point is that none of them has ever claimed that we are practicing Islam completely. And this is one of the reasons we are in need of the government of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam, and may Allah hasten his reappearance. Because of the fact that only in that religion we will see the Islam completely and all the Islamic laws practice. So my point is that there might be some so-called non-Muslim countries which act upon some of the Islamic laws and some Islamic countries in which the Islamic laws are not practiced. The
yes.
famous statement of Sayyid Jamal Asadabadi is very famous, that he traveled to some Western countries and he is quoted as saying, "I saw there Islam and not Muslims. And in the so-called Islamic countries, I saw the Muslims, but not Islam." So my point is that it's not the matter of Islamic countries, non-Islamic countries. It is the matter of practicing the Islamic laws.
Mm-hmm.
We might have an Islamic country in which the Islamic laws are not practiced, and a non-Muslim country in which many of the Islamic values are followed.
That's right.
Now,
and usually because the values that are respected by Islam are humanitarian.
That's,
I mean, most
point.
Of them,
yeah.
Most than 90% are social, for example, focusing on social justice, focusing on the rights of the women, focusing on, we can say, civil rights and this and that. So we can say that why, for example, the Muslim lands, some of the Muslim lands do not practice the laws, but in the Western worlds they are practiced.
Yeah, of course, I don't want to claim that I mean, the rate of the crime in the so-called Muslim countries is higher than
mm-hmm.
the other countries. I will come to that. But
okay.
My point is that we cannot find any country in the world in which all the Islamic laws are practiced. So one may argue that then why you have such a high rate of crime. Let me give our dear listeners an example, which is very, tangible nowadays. I think all the statistics agree that during the holy month of Ramadan in the Islamic countries, the rate of crime is reduced in a very considerable way. So what is the reason why this reduction come from? The point is that in the holy month of Ramadan, the Muslims are more attached to Islamic and human values. They feel a kind of spirituality through fasting, through worshiping God, and so on and so forth. So during the holy month of Ramadan, we have more committed Muslims. We have more practicing Muslims. And it has a very direct effect in the rate of the sins and crimes committed by the people. So that's, I mean, I believe that has a very clear message that as long as you are practicing Islam, then the rate of crimes and sins would be decreased and reduced.
That's right.
And of course, when it comes to Shia countries like Iran, we have the same during the month of Muharram, for example.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Then the other point is that the question talks about some statistics in Islamic countries and non-Islamic countries. And according to this question, the rate of crime is much more in Islamic countries compared to other countries. But a serious question is about the source of these statistics. I checked one of the authentic websites in this regard, which talk about the statistics regarding crimes in different countries, although through a Western understanding, because I will explain that the understanding of the word crime is also different from one country to another, from one ideology to another. But given that we pay attention, we refer to the statistics given by the Westerners. Now, in this list, the first country is Venezuela, which is not at least an Islamic country. And as you see here, people do not talk about the religion which is practiced in this country. No, they talk about this country. But when it comes to some Islamic country, they try to highlight the term Islamic country. Then the second one is New Guinea, Afghanistan, South Africa, Honduras, Trinidad and Tobago, Guyana, Syria, Somalia, Jamaica, Peru, Brazil, Nigeria. And the list goes on and on. For example, the 18th is Argentina. We have a European country like France.
Is it clear what kind of crimes are doing?
That's the point. Okay, I will come to that.
Okay.
France is in the 36th rate. And Islamic Republic of Iran is after the number of 50. So this is a Western source for giving the statistics for the year 2023 regarding the rate of the crimes. So you see the number of the so-called Muslim countries in this list in the first 50 countries is much less than those of non-Muslim countries. So the point is that we shouldn't always, rely on some of the statistics given to us. No,
yes.
By referring to these authentic institutes, we come to this understanding that the statistics are otherwise. Now, the next point is, as you rightly mentioned, about the definition of crime. And this is a very important point. So these usually Western institutions and organizations for giving statistics of crime usually define the word crime as they understand. But the point is that there might be different from one country to another, from one ideology to another, from one religion to another. So, for example, in many of the Islamic countries, to practice some of the sins related to sexual desires is forbidden and is considered as a kind of crime. When it comes to homosexuality, for example, in
yes.
most of the Islamic countries, it is a sin. It is
forbidden,
considered
yes.
as a crime.
Okay.
But in most of the, or in many of the non-Islamic countries, it's not a crime. So maybe that is why they consider the rate of crime in Islamic countries as high, because of the fact that some of the crimes that are regarded by Islamic countries as crime are not regarded as crimes by non-Islamic countries. So from their viewpoint, from their eyes, the number of the crimes are high in the Islamic countries. But from a Muslim perspective, this is not the case. This is the difference in the definition and in defining the word crime. The next point is that when we are told about the rate of crime in Islamic countries, many people remember and are reminded of the acts of violence committed by some of the extremist Muslims, especially the Wahhabis and the ISIS, for example. But the point is that, first of all, these acts are done by a very minority group among Muslims. I'm talking about Wahhabis and the followers of ISIS ideology. So the majority of the Muslims, they denounce these actions done by these people. And so which means that the acts done by these people have nothing to do with the teachings of the religion of Islam.
That's right.
Second of all, in all these wars done by these Wahhabis, I think nowadays at least the majority of the people have come to this understanding that the fire of this war is flamed by some of the superpowers. I think the statement of Hillary Clinton nowadays is very clear in that she confessed that ISIS was founded by some of the Western countries themselves. So it's not a matter of Islamic countries. It's a matter of some superpowers trying to bring problems for Islamic countries through some minorities. And the next point is that, okay, let's imagine that all these crimes done by these minorities are in the name of Islam. What about World War I and the Second? In these wars, according to some statistics, about 60 million people were killed. Is it because of the religion of Islam? And what about in our time and also in the history of different countries? Look, for example, read about the history of China, for example. So the point is that when it comes to the religion of Islam and some acts of violence in our time, first of all, it has nothing to do with the religion of Islam. And second of all, many superpowers are beyond the scene and they are the main actors. And third of all, we have more violent wars in the history of humankind which have nothing to do with the religion of Islam, or in some cases, with any religion.
That's right. Thank you very much, Ekhermi, for a nice elaboration regarding this topic.
And thank you very much to the listeners for listening to this episode of Question and Answer on Islamic Beliefs. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. Li Aliyin wa Husayn wa Hasan. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pereza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
More than 1,700 guests attended the National Day reception in the center of Moscow, hosted by the Iranian embassy, to mark the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution. The reception was attended by top Russian dignitaries, as well as military figures and members of the civil society. Non-Russian diplomats could also be seen at the event.
Basing on objective analysis, I am absolutely sure that now our Russian people with Iranian people should fight together against the great enemy, our common enemy, understanding together each other better and better, as well on the spiritual level.
The prominent philosopher says he predicted that modern Iran and Russia would grow closer years ago. They share the same values, interests, and both belong to the ancient Eurasian civilization. They also seek to bring an end to years of Western dominance and oppression across the globe.
Iran is truly one of a kind in this world. It has one of the most ancient civilizations, and it continues to live up to that legacy. Despite heavy sanctions and pressure, they have made astonishing achievements in the past four decades. People are high-spirited. Iranians yearn for development. I'm very glad that the relations between Iran and Russia are flourishing. Together we can solve many problems in West Asia and around the world.
According to Russian Deputy Prime Minister Alexander Novak, in the last year alone, trade with Iran and Russia has reached $5 billion. The position of the two countries is in tune with a number of international agendas. The two nations oppose the model of a unipolar device and will do everything to defend their sovereignty.
Iran is an example of a harmonious combination of the principles of religion, human rights, and national interests. We maintain a high intensity of political and economic dialogue between our countries. Russian-Iranian cooperation is reaching a qualitatively new strategic level, despite the illegal pressure of unfriendly countries.
The guests of the reception all believed in one thing. The stability of Iran's Islamic Revolution is due to the unquestioning support of people. Iranians are defending their revolution despite constant propaganda, as well as huge funds to overthrow its results.
The anniversary of Iran's 1979 Islamic Revolution is commemorated in Russia every year. As the two countries continue to expand ties, Russian political elite pay their respect to Iran. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Iranians from different walks of life have participated in the commemoration rally from all parts of the metropolitan Tehran to the iconic Azadi Square to mark and celebrate the 44th anniversary of the victory of the Islamic Revolution and renew allegiance with the ideals of the revolution.
The Iranian nation toppled the US-backed Pahlavi regime 44 years ago, ending 2,500 years of monarchy in the country. The Islamic Revolution led by Imam Khomeini established a new political system based on Islamic values and democracy.
The celebration was held in Tehran and over 1,400 cities and 38,000 villages around the Islamic country.
We are here to support our country, and we are here to tell the U.S. to back off so that we can make more improvements in our country. We're going to support this government, this country forever. We're going to support our supreme leader. So you just have to stop interfering in our affairs. And we want to say that down with the U.S. because you've been the cruelest country in the world.
We celebrate the 44th anniversary of the Islamic Revolution to show the world that despite all riots and plots hatched by the enemies, our Islamic Revolution is strong and powerful. We love our leader and the Islamic Revolution and are ready to sacrifice our life for the ideals of our revolution.
Addressing crowds of people at Azadi Square, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said West's policy of imposing imposing sanctions and maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic has failed, thanks to the resistance of the Iranian nation.
West's policy imposing sanctions and maximum pressure on the Islamic Republic has failed, thanks to the resistance of the Iranian nation. The United States and its allies failed to stop the Iranians from making progress. The Iranians managed to make the enemy's plots futile. The West, the U.S. in particular, stands accused of human rights violations by waging wars in countries like Iraq, Afghanistan, and Yemen. The West must be held accountable for its crimes in the region.
The demonstrators underline the necessity of preserving national unity and avoiding any measure that would foment division and sedition in the country. Analysts believe that after 44 years since the victory of the Islamic Revolution, and despite different forms of conspiracies against the Islamic establishment, Iran has now been turned into a beacon of hope for freedom seekers and the oppressed nations of the world. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
Iran's oil-rich city of Ahwaz is hosting 270 local firms active in the production of petroleum equipment, as well as contractors of mega oil projects, to take part in the 13th Ahwaz Oil Show. The aim of the four-day event is to support manufacturers of key petroleum equipment that are on the list of U.S. sanctions.
We have invited all of the local companies operating in oil well services, instrumentation, and the production of any equipment that's required in the oil and gas industry. They are here to achieve synergy with each other and state-owned firms with the ultimate goal of increasing our oil production.
For decades, Iran relied on drilling bits produced by Germany, the U.S., and even China to pump its crude. But U.S. oil embargoes on Iran made it almost impossible to import efficient bits, among other oil exploration and production equipment. This forced Iran to try its own know-how to build its needed machinery, from drilling bits to pipelines.
After almost 110 years of dependence on the import of drilling bits, our engineers at Asmari, along with other Iranian firms, have been able to indigenize the bit technology. So we design and manufacture a range of drilling bits locally, and this is thanks to the restrictions caused by sanctions.
With regard to sour service pipes, our company used to import them for its oil-related projects. We didn't need to reinvent the wheel, but after Trump imposed sanctions on Iran in 2018, we put our heads together and managed to produce our own anti-corrosion pipelines.
In 2018, Iran was the third largest oil producer in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. Following the U.S. reimposition of sanctions against Iran in 2018, Iran's oil output almost halved to less than 2 million barrels a day, while its exports tumbled to less than 1 million BPDs. That's why the government in Iran is now making a seismic shift to local manufacturers to rebuild its oil sector, a long-term goal which, if accomplished, will make the country an oil power.
About seven decades ago, Iran marked a milestone by nationalizing its petroleum industry. Today, it is on track toward indigenizing the strategic sector, something which experts here describe as another turning point in the oil industry. This would shield the country's economy from the impacts of oil embargoes. Yusuf Jalali, Ahvaz.
In line with a fourth meeting of Iran and Russia media cooperation, a delegation of Russian television executives, as well as TV and radio station managers, led by the Russian Deputy Minister of Digital Affairs, visited the IRIB World Service's TV and radio stations. That included the Spanish channel Hispan TV and the English news network Press TV, a chance for the Russian delegation to observe the technical developments up close.
Both the Russian and the Iranian side have reached a point where they are ready for practical steps after holding several rounds of meetings and signing cooperation agreements. We have laid the groundwork, and our audience will soon be enjoying our joint TV and radio productions.
The visit also provided the opportunity to discuss potential areas of cooperation.
We can cooperate in exchange of content. It's movies, TV series, it's cartoons and documentaries. There is a very broad field.
The details were carefully discussed in order to break down the steps and see how the two sides can take cooperation to the next level. First and foremost, representatives were appointed from both sides to be directly in touch and to be in charge of joint media productions from now on.
Iran and Russia are both under pressure and sanctions by Western countries, so this meeting and the one we had 2 days ago are of strategic importance. There is great potential, and I believe that we can immediately begin joint radio production.
But the highlight of this meeting was how to neutralize Western sanctions, particularly in the field of media, with the Iranian side sharing its valuable experiences in this regard.
We are witnessing a new world order, and under these circumstances, regional and international powers such as Russia, Iran, and China will be growing closer and develop stronger alliances. Russians are experiencing sanctions aimed at isolating them since the war in Ukraine has begun. We can share years of experience with them in this regard. Our media cooperation not only allows unheard voices to be heard, but it will also reshape public opinion.
Both sides agree that the groundwork is prepared and joint production can start in 2023, marking the beginning of a strategic alliance in a multipolar world where all voices can be heard. Gisumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
An accord sealed in early January between the Italian multi-utility company Iren and Israel's water carrier Mekorot has triggered protests in a number of Italian cities. As a multi-utility firm, Iren, which operates solely in Italy's northern regions, provides services related to gas, electricity and water. The company's four major shareholders are the municipalities of Genoa, Turin, Parma and Reggio Emilia. On Tuesday, a council meeting held in the northwestern city of Genoa ended up in chaos, with some opposition councillors staging a protest against the Iren-Mekorot deal.
Mekorot is accused of stealing water supplies from Palestinians in the occupied territories. Through the denial of access to water and sanitation, Mekorot collaborates with the far-right cabinet of Israel in the implementation of institutionalized water apartheid, which is a central component of Israel's policies of ethnic cleansing of Palestinian communities. We believe the deal should be scrapped.
Over the past years, companies in a number of countries, including Portugal, Argentina and the Netherlands, have pulled out of deals signed with Mekorot. The decision to sever ties with Israel's water company followed protests over Mekorot's role in Tel Aviv's water apartheid against Palestinians. Israel's Mekorot provides drinking water for Israeli settlers and infrastructure for water supplies in the illegal settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories. Not only Israel is accused of manipulating water supplies, but it also prohibits the construction of water networks to provide drinking water in cities and villages. Humanitarian organizations accuse Israel of violating Palestinians' rights, included in several international agreements and conventions.
Israel is stealing all the water of Palestine. Mekorot has been signing deals with many international companies across the world, and now it's Italy's turn. We denounce Israel's criminal policy of water apartheid against Palestinians and will call on Italy to respect international accords.
It is estimated that while the Palestinian population of the West Bank has doubled since the Israeli occupation formally began in 1967, water allocation for Palestinians has remained at 1997 levels. It's not just the Genoa's councillors who are calling on the municipality to scrap the Iren-Mekorot deal. Councillors from the municipalities of Reggio Emilia, Turin and Parma have demanded the governments to do the same. Max Civili, Rome.
The fifth meeting of security representatives from several countries to address Afghanistan problems has been held in the Russian capital, Moscow. Participants have come up with a number of practical measures to take joint actions in the fight against terrorism. The measures include curbing terrorism finances, intensifying cooperation in the field of combating transnational organized crime, illegal arms and drug trafficking, and preventing illegal migration. The measures come at a time when the U.S. authorities are using the frozen Afghan assets as a tool to blackmail the country. In December, Russia's permanent representatives to the UN, Vasily Nebenzia, called on Washington to immediately return the funds stolen from the Afghan people. He called the U.S. freezing of Afghanistan's assets outrageous. This, as Afghan authorities are still reaping the fruits of chaos left by the Americans, and the situation in the socioeconomic sphere is rapidly degrading.
Washington, London, and their allies continue to freeze Afghan assets illegally instead of allocating them for humanitarian works. Moreover, attempts are being made by Western countries to plunder the funds, including by setting aside part of them to pay compensation to relatives of September 11 attacks victims, in which the Afghan people were not involved.
The Iranian representatives called the situation in Afghanistan a consequence of the U.S. policy.
Iran is a country hosting the largest number of refugees from Afghanistan. They are provided with a variety of opportunities, including higher education through state subsidies. Approximately 300 to 350,000 children from Afghanistan study in our schools, and about 6,000 Afghans study at Iranian universities. We do not have any camps for refugees. Afghans live on an equal footing with other Iranian citizens. We do not make any discriminatory distinction between Iranian and Afghan students. Moreover, given the difficult economic situation in Afghanistan, we grant scholarships to refugee families for the education of their children.
The secretaries of national security of the participant countries described the U.S. strategy in Afghanistan as pre-planned and prepared. Under the pretext of fighting the terrorist group that Washington itself created, the U.S. wants to force Afghanistan's neighboring countries to open their doors to American bases. That's a policy aimed at expanding the U.S. presence in the region. Such meetings are seen as an attempt to neutralize and contain the U.S. approach. The Moscow format on Afghanistan was created in 2017 that brought together Russia, Afghanistan, China, Pakistan, Iran, and India. Later, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Tajikistan, and Uzbekistan joined as well. Participants have so far held several meetings aimed at helping Afghanistan, which has been devastated by years of the U.S.-led war. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
A conference near the UK Houses of Parliament to mark the 12th anniversary of the Bahraini people's uprising against the Al Khalifa regime. A reminder that the reverberations of what happened on Pearl Square in 2011 continue to be felt today.
There is a momentum for the revolution that the crisis has not ended. It is there. It is escalating by the day. It's not really diminishing at all. And it is our feeling that the people will not give up unless there is a good degree of concessions. And my feeling also, the regime cannot do that.
This is what it looked like when the Islamic awakening reached the Kingdom of Bahrain 12 years ago. The protesters' main demands, socioeconomic justice and democracy. What they got from the regime, though, a state of emergency and a violent crackdown that lasted for months, aided and abetted by Saudi Arabia and the UAE. Many were killed or injured, many more jailed or exiled, making Bahrain a country with one of the worst human rights records. Yet none of that impacted its relations with the corridors of power here in the UK, which lists Bahrain as a core market for its arms sales.
The relationship that the UK government has is a special relationship because historically it has been an ally of successive repressive regimes. For a single purpose, well, a dual purpose. One is obviously the issue with regard to oil, and the second is the strategic importance of Bahrain. And what we've seen is a pattern of governments, successive governments of all political persuasions, put those interests, both strategic and with regard to oil economic, above the basic civil liberties and human rights of the people of Bahrain.
The kingdom is also host to American and British military bases. Neither country offered any support for the uprising at the time.
Bahrain has an embassy in London, and the UK is one of four European countries to maintain an embassy in Manama. The participants here say it's time the UK government rethought its cozy relationship with the regime in Manama, held it accountable, and stood up for the people of Bahrain. Saeed Bourza, London.
In recent months, Alexei Reznikov has been mixing at the highest levels within NATO and the EU. He's just been sacked as Ukraine's defense minister amid a fresh corruption scandal. There was no mention of this at a press conference following a meeting of EU affairs ministers in Brussels on Monday. It was confirmed, however, that attempts are being made to apply more pressure on Russia over the war in Ukraine.
We continue to work on the 10th package of sanctions to be in place by 24th of February, 1 year after the invasion started.
EU taxpayers have already sent 50 billion euro to Ukraine. Ministers pledged on Monday to keep the money flowing. This as mortgage repayments in the eurozone are going up after the European Central Bank increased interest rates. Citizens have been talking to us about the cost of living crisis.
I bought my house, and so it's very, very hard to pay.
My weekly bill went from 50 euros per week to 100, 150, and I live alone. So
with 50 euros, you cannot buy some food for a week. You can just buy for 1 or 2 days.
It's several hundred, definitely. Several hundred euros per month.
More than you were paying?
Yeah.
The ECB is raising interest rates to try and control inflation, but it's damaging the EU's competitiveness. There's concern employment will be impacted.
Credit to the private sector is becoming more expensive. Bank lending to firms has decelerated sharply over recent months.
Analysts say EU sanctions against Russia are backfiring as higher energy costs spread throughout the bloc's entire economy. There is no relief in sight for mortgage holders in the eurozone. The ECB has indicated it will increase rates further in March. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Join us in this journey. This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
British Petroleum, known as BP, has cut its climate pledges while reporting record-shattering profits. According to reports, BP is planning more fossil fuel output than expected after reporting a record $28 billion in profits for 2022. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. Noted in this regard, BP, a London-based oil giant that has attempted to style itself as a leader of the renewable energy transition, announced recently that it is slashing its emission reduction goals and planning more fossil fuel output than previously expected, after reporting a record $28 billion in profits for 2022, more than double what it made the year before. Compared to its earlier plan to curtail fossil fuel production by 40% below 2019 levels, the company said it now intends to cut output by just 25% by 2030. BP correspondingly now aims for a fall of 20% to 30% in emissions from the carbon in its oil and gas production in 2030, compared to a 2019 baseline, lower than the previous aim of 35 to 40%, the company said in a press release. The oil giant also said it plans to pour just as much money, up to $8 billion, into its fossil fuel businesses as its so-called transition growth engines, which include renewables by 2030. BP's announcement came a day after the head of the United Nations said fossil fuel companies that can't establish credible plans to sharply reduce carbon emissions should not be in business. "We need a renewable revolution, not a self-destructive fossil fuel resurgence," said UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres. BP's decision to scale down its climate goals drew the ire of campaigners and scientists who stressed that growing fossil fuel production is imperiling global hopes of having and staving off even more catastrophic warming. "Just when we need to be rolling back oil and gas production, BP is rolling back its climate commitments," said Doug Parr, Greenpeace UK's chief scientist, adding, "Don't let the spin disguise it. This looks like BP edging back to being a traditional oil company." Climate scientist Bill Maguire argued BP's announcement further demonstrates that fossil fuel companies can't be trusted to voluntarily cut production and potentially sacrifice short-term profits for the sake of the climate, no matter how splashly their pledges and rebrands. BP cuts its emissions pledge and plans a greater production of oil and gas over the next 7 years compared with previous targets, Maguire tweeted, adding, "This is criminal. Fossil fuel cores must be forced to stop drilling. It is our only chance now." BP is the latest oil and gas behemoth to report record-shattering profits for 2022, a banner year for fossil fuel companies, thanks in large part to the ongoing energy market impacts of the Russia-Ukraine crisis. In its fourth quarter earnings announcement, BP said it would boost its dividend and buy back an additional $2.75 billion worth of its own shares. The company repurchased $11.25 billion of its stock last year. "Importantly, we are delivering for our shareholders with buybacks and a growing dividend," BP CEO Bernard Looney said in a statement, adding, "This is exactly what we said we would do and will continue to do, performing while transforming." Freya Atchison, oil and gas campaigner at Friends of the Earth Scotland, called BP's profits sickening and said fossil fuel giants are being allowed to bank billions in profits whilst millions of ordinary people struggle to pay their bills. Atchison added, "Bosses and shareholders at these big polluters are being allowed to get even richer by profiteering from one of our most basic needs, the harm caused by the fossil fuel energy system couldn't be clearer. Saying these companies are not serious about climate action or transitioning away from oil and gas, the evidence shows they are spending just a tiny fraction of their profits into truly green projects.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Salamun alaikum. You are listening to Lantern, and we have a new story. Androcles and the Lion. In Rome, there was once a poor slave whose name was Androcles. His master was a cruel man, and so unkind to him that at last Androcles ran away. He hid himself in a wild wood for many days, but there was no food to be found, and he grew so weak and sick that he thought he should die. So one day he crept into a cave and lay down, and soon he was fast asleep. After a while, a great noise woke him up. A lion had come into the cave and was roaring loudly. Androcles was very much afraid, so he felt sure that the beast would kill him. Soon, however, he saw that the lion was not angry, but that he limped as though his foot hurt him. Then Androcles grew so bold that he took hold of the lion's lame paw to see what was the matter. The lion still stood quiet still and rubbed his head against the man's shoulder. He seemed to say, "I know that you will help me." Androcles lifted the paw from the ground and saw that it was a long, sharp thorn which hurt the lion so much. He took the end of the thorn in his finger, then he gave a stone quick pull, and out it came. The lion was full of joy. He jumped about like a dog and licked the hands and feet of his new friend. Androcles was not at all afraid after this, and when night came, he and the lion lay down and slept side by side. For a long time, the lion brought food to Androcles every day. And the two became such good friends that Androcles found his new friend, his new life, a very happy one. One day, some soldiers who were passing through the wood found Androcles in the cave. They knew who he was and so took him back to Rome. It was the law at that time that every slave who ran away from his master should be made to fight a hungry lion. So a fierce lion was shut up for a while without food, and a time was set for the fight. When the day came, thousands of people crowded to see the sport. They went to such places at the time very much as people nowadays go to see a circus show or a game of baseball. The door opened. The poor Androcles was brought in. He was almost dead with fear, for the roars of lion could already be heard. He looked up and saw that there was no pity in the thousands of faces around him. Then the hungry lion rushed in. With a single bound, he reached the poor slave. Androcles gave a great cry, not of fear, but of gladness. It was his old friend, the lion of the cave. The people who had expected to see the man killed by the lion were filled with wonder. They saw Androcles put his arms around the lion's neck. They saw the lion lie down at his feet and lick them lovingly. They saw the great beast rub his head against the slave's face as though he wanted to be petted. they could not understand what it all meant. After a while, they asked Andraklos to tell them about it. So he stood up before them and with his arm around the lion's neck told how he and the beast have lived together in the cave. "I am a man," he said, "but no man has ever befriended me. This poor lion alone has been kind to me, and we love each other as brothers." The people were not so bad that they could be cruel to the poor slave now. "Live and be free," they cried. "Live and be free," they cried. "Live and be free. Live and be free," others cried. "Let the lion go free too. Give both of them their liberty." And so Andraklos was set free, and the lion was given to him for his own, and they lived together in Rome for many years.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. This is Lantern. I am Bita, and I'm at your service. This is Arabic English Radio. A new day, a new perspective, a new story, and a new conclusion from another perspective. So, kindness is love. Love is kindness. You know, love is kindness. It's being selfless, caring, compassionate, and unconditionally kind. Exactly like love. It takes practice to understand and feel it. We share love with others through kind acts such as a smile, a nice word, and an unexpected deed or a planned surprise. When we offer these acts to others, we make people feel good. We pass along hope. We promote peace. We show the power of kindness. And at last, kindness is grace. As you know, we are humans, and therefore we make mistakes. We can be kind in our response to ourselves and others when those mistakes occur. This means thinking before speaking, forgiving before seeking revenge, and thinking about long-term relationships instead of short-term pride. And exactly we saw that things in the story, the long-term impact of kindness. It is exactly the expression of kindness's grace. So, in this part, we're going to go through a beautiful poem in Persian poetry, which is "Tu niki mikono dar dojlandas, khodavand dar biyabanat dahat bas." I don't want to translate this poem, and I want to recite and narrate a story for you. Then we're going to translate and define this beautiful poem for you, dear listeners. Let's go for this story. Mutawakkil was a king who ruled in ancient times. He had a son named Fatah. One day, Mutawakkil decided to teach Fat how to sing. So he sent him to the river with some skimmers to teach him how to sing. But the water flow was too fast, and Fat was carried away. The noise reached Mutawakkil's ears, and he made him so upset. So he said that whoever brings me the Fat, I will give him many rewards. And he said that I will not eat until the day you don't bring fat for me.
The Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
On the other hand, Fat tried his best to reach a hole in the water, and he said that he should wait until he sees what God wants. He was hopeful here. After 7 days, the Zoomers found Fat and brought him safely to Mutavakil. Mutavakil gave them reward and ordered the servants to bring food for Fat. But Fat said, "I'm full." Mutavakil said, "How full are you? But what have you eaten in these 7 days?" Fat said, "Every day, a number of loaves of bread came on the water with the inscription Muhammad ibn al-Husayn al-Askaf written on them." So, Mutavakil said, "How can I believe that? We have to find this person." And then they announced these to all the people, and a day this man was found and said that it was me. Mutavakil said, "How can I believe you?" The man said, "Because I write on the bread, Muhammad ibn al-Husayn al-Askaf." Mutavakil said, "Why are you doing this?" The man said, "I have heard that they say that you do good and God will return it in difficult times. I'm also a poor man and I had nothing but bread. So I threw the bread into the river." Mutavakil said, "Now you will see the answer of your good deeds." And he gave him 5 lands, and he and his sons started farming on the lands and gaining a lot of wealth. This was a beautiful story about being kind to each other in Persian poems. And about the poem I narrated for you, the meaning of that was you have to good an act of kindness and you will see that God will return your kindness in the future. It was all for the aspect of kindness in this story, which we have to know that we all have a short life in this life. This is not all. We can be kind to each other without any expectation. And another aspect of the story was about freedom and slavery. Slavery and enslavement are both the state and the condition of being a slave, who is someone forbidden to quit serving an enslaver, and is treated by the enslaver as property. Hopefully, in modern world, we don't see such a thing, but we have been enslaved by many things in our lives. Don't forget that. We are human beings, and human beings are free. One of the most important blessings that God has blessed us with is freedom. We are free to be kind and give this beautiful kindness to the world. That was all the time we had for today's episode. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening to us. I bid you farewell and I leave you in the warm embrace of Allah. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.